From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief James Glanz about covering militias, bombings, politics, and oil in Iraq and some of the dangers he's faced in the process. We'll also talk about current negotiations between the U.S. and Iraq that could set the terms for an extended U.S. presence there. Glanz has been rotating in and out of Iraq for the past 4 years. He's currently on the stateside part of his rotation and has just written about a government study criticizing the Bush administration for overstating progress in Iraq. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Hopkins, the new ABC documentary series set in Johns Hopkins University Hospital. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Glanz, is the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. For the past 4 years, he's been rotating in and out of Iraq. He recently began a stateside part of his rotation. This week, he reported on a government study which found the Bush administration has overstated progress in Iraq. He also wrote this week about a Democratic effort in the Senate to block Iraq's decision to award no-bid service contracts to several Western oil companies, including ExxonMobil, Shell, and BP. As the Times' Baghdad bureau chief, Glanz manages a compound that at any given time includes between 100 and 120 Iraqis and 6 to 15 Western reporters and photographers. James Glanz, welcome to Fresh Air. People have been talking about how coverage of the war in Iraq has decreased, and your paper in the New York Times just ran an article that quoted a study compiled by Andrew Tyndall, who's a TV consultant, and he monitors the three evening newscasts on the three networks. And he said coverage of Iraq has been, quote, massively scaled back this year, unquote. CBS no longer has a single full-time correspondent in Iraq. Do you have a sense of why that's happening?
Well, we talk about it a lot. It's not just reporters, by the way. It's also photographers. Some of the big agencies who've covered wars from time immemorial often don't even have a photographer in country. And I just think it's a combination of things. One, it's a logistically challenging place in the extreme. So in order to operate there, you have to run your own security. You have to have a place to stay. You have to have the right telecommunications, all that. And then second, it can be very frustrating, not to mention dangerous, as a correspondent there, because it's not only dangerous to get the story, but it's just tough to get places and get people who will give you information. It'll take you 3 days to do something that takes a couple of hours in New York, let's say. So there's that. And then, of course, there doesn't seem to be as much appetite on the part of the reading public or the viewing public.
Do you think there's the sense that bombings and casualties have become business as usual so that people aren't paying much attention? You know, readers and viewers aren't paying that much attention to them anymore?
Well, that's dispiriting, but I think there's an element of truth to that. When we first were over there, of course, in 2003, then in 2004 when I showed up, I remember constantly being woken up in the morning by a big bombing, and you get sensitive after a while to exactly where the bomb went off. You sort of get like a homing pigeon sense of where things are, or a bat sense of where things are from the sound and the size of it. And we'd tumble into a car, rush out on the street, and, you know, we'd go out there, do the story. If there were a lot of casualties, as often as not, it would lead the paper the next day. Now, you know, it's not really journalistically worth our while to cover every one of those bombings so intensively, first of all, because there isn't as much interest. As you say, again, in a very dispiriting way, it sort of seems like business as usual, I think, to a lot of readers and viewers. And then second, it's, again, more dangerous because you get out there and you never know what militia may be in charge of that area. You get shot. And the Iraqi government has instituted all kinds of rules about what you can and can't show on the street. So for a lot of different reasons, it does seem that a bombing just doesn't get the attention it used to.
How has the diminishing number of American reporters in Iraq changed what you cover or how you cover it or what your sense of responsibility is to covering as much of the story as possible?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, we do feel a high sense of responsibility, those of us who are still in Iraq reporting on the story. And that's not just the New York Times. A lot of other news organizations there still working.
Though we should mention that some newspapers have cut their foreign desks altogether.
They have, and that has a sort of secondary domino effect on any given bureau, let's say the Baghdad bureau for a lot of those organizations. That's right. And I personally, and I think I speak for my colleagues, you know, we like to see, so to speak, the competition out there. It keeps us on our toes, and we feel that if we miss something, they'll catch it, and it brings a more rounded story to the reading public. At this point, in one sense, it's easier, of course, because you don't have as many people out there scrambling for the same story. So as a reporter, you know, if something happens or you get a tip, you actually have longer to cover it, and you can take your time because you don't really hear footsteps as soon as you did before. But I think all in all, it doesn't serve, you know, a democracy like the United States or the, you know, the reading public in the world to have fewer voices out of this country, because inevitably, you know, more eyes, more voices, you know, more pens, more cameras just means more points of view and more information on what is still the biggest story in the world.
You reported this week on a Government Accountability Office study that reported several of the Bush administration's measures of progress in Iraq were either incorrect or far more mixed than the administration acknowledged. What are a couple of the key Bush administration measures that are challenged by this report?
Right. Well, in Iraq, you know, there's a fog of war, the likes of which I don't know that we've ever seen before. So, you know, I preface my remarks by saying it's always unclear with the administration whether, you know, there's a bit of wishful thinking in their numbers or whether it's just as tough for them to get information right as it is for us. And you see a lot of disagreement on really basic things in Iraq for just that reason. It's very, very hard to pin down the simplest numbers, and we find that every day. So with that preamble, it is true that the Government Accountability Office, which has done some of the best studies, I think, on ground truth in Iraq, is finding that crucial things like the readiness of the Iraqi military may be overstated by Pentagon reports. The Pentagon is saying that, for example, 70% of the Iraqi units now are in the lead in counterinsurgency operations. Government Accountability Office sees that number as low as 10%. And there's a combination of reasons why that number is different, but as you can see, it's a huge difference in their assessment. Second, you know, there's been a lot of interest recently on how much money Iraq is spending, you know, its own money, on reconstructing the country. And the Bush administration and the Iraqi government has been touting its progress. They're saying that they're up to about 60 to 70% of their allocated funds for reconstruction, that they've actually spent that and built things. Whereas, again, the accountability office is coming in and saying it's somewhere between 11 and I think 28% was the number. So tremendous difference in certain respects in their assessment of ground truth in Iraq.
As you go back and forth between Baghdad and the United States reporting for The New York Times, do you ever sense a difference between what you've observed firsthand in Iraq and what the Bush administration is telling the American public about progress being made there?
Yeah, I'm sure there's an element of politics here, right? Because they're trying to make various political points about which I know nothing. I'm not a political reporter. But again, there's just another element of just, you know, whenever an organization of any kind undertakes an operation or some kind of project and we're called upon to report on it, you know, their assessment of it is going to be rosier probably than the article we write about it, because we're not involved in it, you know, and we don't have that motivation to try to pump things up. In the case of the administration, yeah, they've spent 5 years now pushing forward this effort in Iraq, but at the same time, they've also had a tremendous public relations effort to try to promote progress there. And we grapple with that every day. What's interesting about it is that the storyline changes. I mean, at one point, it'll be that, you know, the provinces are doing amazing things and building things and forgetting about Baghdad because Baghdad's ministries have fallen off the map and don't know how to function properly. Then the next day it'll be that the ministries are actually taking control, you know, and in one case it'll be the tribal sheikhs are doing great things, and the next time it'll be political figures or something, and the tribal sheikhs don't matter, whatever. You know, it goes on and on. The story goes around and around, but at any given time they'll be pushing a storyline, and our job is always to sort of try not to listen to it in a sense and just get the facts. And sometimes we find the same thing they're telling us. And sometimes we find something that's very different. And so it's just, you know, the gap is generally pretty large, let's put it that way, and we have to deal with that.
Is there an example of that kind of gap now that you observe?
You take the case of the Basra Children's Hospital down in the southern city of Basra, which was first put forward as a big project, or at least promoted by the First Lady, Laura Bush. We heard progress report after progress report on that hospital over the years. We're supposed to have a big X-ray facility and other high-tech things to treat children. And it turned out then at a certain point, we had a good set of engineers go in that did an investigation, and really there was nothing there. There was the violence had stopped them from pouring concrete. The big machines were nowhere to be found because you couldn't put them in there in that environment. And the whole thing had come to a standstill why we were receiving all of these bullish reports on the project. And that's not an isolated case. That's happened again and again. I think to their credit, now they've gone back to that project and they're working on it again. But we're never able to take at face value the press releases we receive on progress in rebuilding in Iraq.
My guest is James Glanz, the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Glanz, and he's the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been going in and out of Iraq for the past 4 years. In March of this year, you wrote an incredible piece about being in the alleys in the slum of Sadr City, which is controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. Would you describe what you saw there in the alleys of Sadr City?
Sure. It's very tough to get into Sadr City, and you have to sort of wind your way through back streets usually, and you have to know everybody on every corner. And what you see depends on exactly where you are. There are some relatively, especially in the eastern part of Sadr City, there are some relatively upscale sections, but most of it is a slum. And, you know, what you'd think of as a street is really kind of an uneven alley with big potholes and dust and lots of little children staring at you suspiciously from windows and things like that. But you also always find that each little alley literally is controlled by some Mahdi commander or sub-commander. And they'll have to know who you are. You will not pass. And back then, which was only a couple of months ago, they were preparing for the Americans to come in. So they were wiring up those alleys with bombs. And I wasn't paying much attention to the activity around me. I wanted to get an interview with this deputy commander of an alley, basically, is what I called him in the piece, and that's what he was. And at one point, one of my best war photographers who'd come with me, a completely fearless person named Joao Silva, said, "Jim, it's time to go." And I said, "Joao, I just started the interview." And he said, "Jim, it's time to go." So I never turned my back on that kind of advice from Joao. We got in the car and went. But as I turned around, I realized there were wires going past my feet that I hadn't noticed. There were people laying them out. And as we talked in the car and I looked back, he pointed out to me that they were laying an IED, that's an improvised explosive device, a bomb, into the street only feet away from me. And at the same time, an unmanned drone, which sometimes can carry a Hellfire missile, an American drone was flying overhead, and there was an Apache helicopter on the horizon. So Joao's calculation was the interview wasn't worth getting wasted by a Hellfire missile. And that's sort of the way it is in Sadr City. You go in there, and unless you know somebody, you're not going in. And unless you really know what you're doing, you know, you can come to an end pretty quickly. So you really have to know what you're doing in Sadr City, and I think you also have to be lucky.
How did you get that far? You said you have to know somebody in order to get from street to street. Who did you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing about Iraq, you know, it's not so different from a lot of places in that, you know, connections are everything. In Iraq, it's even more important. You have to know somebody, somebody's cousin, or, you know, somebody who's been a neighbor of one of your drivers for 25 years and who saved his son's life once and, you know, et cetera. You know, there's this giant web of understandings and connections and relationships that you develop there, not just you personally, but the people you're working with, the Iraqis you work with. And that's sort of your lubricant for getting into those kinds of places. They also know that you're telling their story, and that's really important. We forget that sometimes. When we come in, you know, they have every motivation to dislike me as an American because the stance of Muqtada al-Sadr, their leader, is that the what he calls the American occupier should leave. But they completely overlook that. They agree to overlook that because they know that we're coming in to tell their story to the world, and that makes a big difference. And so those are some of the things you use, not all of the sort of tricks of the trades there, but some of the ways that you get into those difficult spots in Iraq.
Muqtada al-Sadr's militiamen control the alleys of Sadr City. They have IEDs. They control them without. How else do they control the alleys, and why is that so important?
Well, let me, I'm trying to think of the right analogy. You know, in the piece you mentioned, I remember being in back in Chicago, a place I lived for a long time, and imagining an occupying army coming in and trying to have its way with the place. You know, and if that many people are all related or having they all live there, they're of one culture, and they sort of don't want you there, the lines of communication are just intense. So the sinews of what I want to say, resistance, if you will, in those alleys are very thick and numerous. They all sort of operate together. It's, you know, when an order comes down for people to leave an area, they all just leave. If there's supposed to be a demonstration, believe me, everybody shows up for the demonstration. I've been in Sadr City, and they can turn out tens of thousands. I don't know if he can get a million people out there, but he can approach it on a given day. So it's a very sort of, I'm trying to find the right word. You know, when you come in as a foreigner, what you meet is a group of people who are of the kind of culture that works very well together, and there's an understanding out there that if the local commander says he's received the word to do X, then you're all going to do X.
I think one of the difficulties that Muqtada al-Sadr presents for the United States is that he has this, like, really resistant militia, right, that's really good at what they do. But then he'll call for these long ceasefires, and then things quiet down, the picture looks rosier, and then he'll tell his militia to take up arms again. And so, like, the ceasefires never seem to necessarily be something that's going to last for very long. Is that part of his strategy, to be very unpredictable and to basically be setting the ground rules by calling these ceasefires on and off?
Oh, you bet it is. Yeah, I wouldn't call, from what we understand, I wouldn't call Muqtada al-Sadr a brilliant strategist, but he knows his country, and he knows he's not strong enough to go toe-to-toe with any of the other military forces in the country, or many of them. That includes certainly the United States and probably now the Iraqi army. So remember, this is a guy who survived the Saddam Hussein years, and whose father was killed by Saddam, and whose father-in-law was killed by Saddam. And he sort of took the mantle of the family and made it through. And he did that also with a series of sort of tactical retreats when his father was murdered by Saddam's men in a square, I believe in Najaf. He didn't come out, as people would call him, as like the firebrand cleric, and say that Saddam killed my father. He just laid low, and he knows how to do that. And he uses that trick again and again and again when he doesn't think that he can make his point by military force. And in this latest case, when the Prime Minister Maliki decided to undertake this assault on Basra, you saw that whole dynamic play out. The first thing that happened was the Iraqi military got nowhere, because the Mahdi army in that place was stronger than they were. And it wasn't until Muqtada decided to send out the word that his fighters should stand down that the government forces took the city, if you want to put the word took in quotation marks. That's what happened.
I guess it's hard to defeat him, because anytime he thinks he's going to be defeated, he calls a ceasefire, and then, you know, the militia kind of disappears, so you can't defeat them. And then when he's ready, he comes back again.
Oh, you bet. I mean, that's a street fighter, you know. He comes out, he says, this is my corner, and you're not going anywhere, we're going to stop you. And then when he realizes he's beat, he melts away into the shadows. I mean, what do you do with somebody like that? It must be a nightmare to be an American commander and try to strategize around an enemy like that.
Meanwhile, part of the American strategy in Iraq is to pay men in Sunni militias to help the Americans fight insurgents and fight, you know, Islamic extremist groups. And that has contributed to any signs of calm that have developed in the past few months. And I'm wondering if you have met any of the militia men who have accepted the money in return for siding with the Americans.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because they're out on the street. So we'll go out there and talk with them. And the interesting thing about Iraq is that someone can go from, you know, the most dangerous insurgent, at least in theory, to the sort of the corner cop overnight. And it's a shape-shifting kind of a place. And when you go out there, you just you can't even sort of recreate in your mind how this sort of inoffensive kid, in which a lot of them are, standing out there with a nice new tan uniform supplied by the Americans might have been the person who was planning a bomb that could have blown up my own car, you know, a few months before that. And that's one of the realities of Iraq, I think, that's not much appreciated, is that, you know, there are people that is used to historically living under occupation, and people in that condition are very good at concealing their real intentions. You know, sort of they're keeping their night job separate from their day job. And when the people you're talking about, now they're called Sons of Iraq is the term that's used for that group, sort of became the corner cops, they actually come out and they keep the peace. It's the most bizarre thing, but they really do bring down the violence, again, as long as they decide to do it.
James Glanz is the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org. From Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the quiet negotiations between the U.S. and Iraq that could set the terms for an extended U.S. presence there. We continue our conversation with James Glanz, Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. And David Bianculli reviews Hopkins, a new ABC documentary series set in Johns Hopkins University Hospital. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Glanz, the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been rotating in and out of Iraq for the past 4 years and is currently on a stateside portion of his rotation. When we left off, we were talking about some of the issues that make the future of Iraq difficult to predict. Meanwhile, the UN resolution authorizing the American role in Iraq expires at the end of this year. What does that mean?
I think it's pretty important. I mean, you know, rules and mandates and all those sorts of things in Iraq are pretty fungible for the most part. But, you know, at this point, the United States has made it very clear that it is doing what Iraq thinks is best to put the country on its feet. And it's said over and over again that Iraqi troops are in the lead, and that it was asked by the prime minister to undertake this support action or what have you, and that it is very much not an occupation in the view of the administration and the American commanders there. So that, I think, that view of the conflict on the American side makes this expiration much more important, because what they have to do is negotiate their reason for being there now with the Iraqi government. And the Iraqi government knows that this is going to be important, and that they, I wouldn't say have the United States over a barrel, but have some pretty strong levers for getting some things they want in these negotiations.
Well, you know, a recent New York Times editorial about the end of this forthcoming expiration of the UN resolution authorizing the American role in Iraq means that the U.S. and Iraq have been quietly negotiating a deal. And the editorial said that, according to Iraqi leaders, Washington has been insisting on keeping more than 50 long-term bases in Iraq. Assuming that's true, that Washington is insisting on that, what would the implications of that be?
I think they'd be major. I really do. I mean, I think that, as I said before, I think the shape of this agreement is actually important. And if you have the kind of presence that, you know, entails maybe a headquarters in Baghdad, a couple of provincial outposts, and then, you know, a force ready in Turkey to come down if there are problems, that's a very different thing than having Americans within, you know, 100 miles of any given spot in the country, you know, so that they could be there with Black Hawk helicopters in a matter of minutes. You know, that's two totally different situations. And that would lead to two totally different, relationships with the Iraqi government, and, differences in our ability to prop up the kind of regime we'd like to see there.
President Bush's term is about to expire, and time is running out for, you know, the end of the negotiation of this deal, because it runs out in December. So does this mean that President Bush will be negotiating, or the Bush administration will be negotiating, America's future in Iraq just as they're on the verge of leaving, and a new president will be coming in?
I think that's right. And remember that another little truth that you come to understand after being in Iraq in a while, it's a place where going to the brink is the way to get anything done. Just because it's convenient to somebody else to have, you know, an agreement done 4 months before it was just due to expire, that doesn't mean anything in the Iraqi mind. So I do think that it'll come down to the wire. Everything does in Iraq, and the Iraqis will press their advantage. And I think that it'll probably be very tough for the Bush administration to remain focused on this right up until the closing minutes of its tenure. But if they want to get the agreement, I suspect they're going to have to do that.
But so it means that the Bush administration, on its way out, will be setting the terms for America's future presence in Iraq.
Well, that's an interesting question. Would the next president come in and say, we've got to renegotiate this immediately? Would there be some loophole in there that would allow, you know, the next president to change certain parts of it? I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but I do believe that just as with the Iraqi constitution, which took forever and ever to negotiate, the exact words that go down on paper, in some ways will have an influence. It may not be the law of the land that the negotiators want, because it just doesn't work that way there. People follow some things and they ignore others, and that's just the way even high-level politicians work that way there. But it will make a big difference if they come out and say, we're allowing, let's say, 60 bases in Iraq, versus saying, you know, you're not going to have that. And remember that in terms of conflict, if you're just talking about the commanders call the kinetic part of this effort, the fighting, 60 bases is not a lot. If you want to fight, if you want to keep fighting, and you think you're going to have to keep fighting, you will need 60 bases. There's a lot of space out there. There's a lot of desert and a lot of places for the bad guys to come from. But if you think that you've gotten to the point where political reconciliation or some kind of reconciliation among the parties is at hand, well, that's a different situation. Then 60 bases starts to seem like a pretty big housekeeping chore.
My guest is James Glanz, the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Glanz, and he's the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. And for the past 4 years, he's been rotating in and out of Iraq. He's on a stateside part of that rotation right now. One of the things you've been reporting about from Washington is the fact that more than four Western oil companies are about to sign service contracts, short-term service contracts, with Iraq. And this has been met with a lot of skepticism in the cynicism, I maybe should say, in the States for two reasons. One is that there are no bid contracts. And two is that for a lot of people, it just seems to kind of reinforce their fear that the war was about oil and about getting access to oil. So let's kind of back up. And maybe you can tell us what these contracts include. What do these contracts give the Western oil companies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that story was broken by my colleague Andrew Kramer in Baghdad not long ago. And I was just talking about it this morning by phone with my deputy in Baghdad, Lissa Rubin. And the contracts themselves are pretty simple and by no means lucrative. They just allow the Iraqi oil industry to send workers out for some training. The companies will analyze seismic data and things like that to try to figure out the size of fields and things. It's not very elaborate, not very large. But they are no bid, and they come with the promise that they'll have some advantages in later bidding on more substantial contracts, you know, for actually exploiting the fields. And that's the really controversial part of the whole thing. So the companies have been angling for this for quite a while. When I first reported that they were working with the Iraqi government on certain issues of this of just this kind, I was assured by the oil ministry in Baghdad that there would never be any advantage given to these companies in future bidding just because they were helping out the Iraqi government. That was an absolute statement they gave me, and that turns out not to be the case at this point. And of course, that's what the companies wanted all along. I mean, you know, companies are supposed to make money. They're supposed to look for their own advantage, and that's what they've been doing. Why the Iraqi government decided to go this route, I'm not exactly sure. But one thing that Alyssa was pointing out to me this morning is that you have to be aware that it's going to play entirely differently in Iraq than it does in the United States. Here, you know, the storyline is, and understandably, that you have big multinational companies, Western-led companies, going in and sort of giving some justification to this, you know, theory that the administration has always said has been a conspiracy theory, that the United States really went in for the oil. And, of course, there's a kind of a suspicion of these big companies that we understand in the West and have as part of our whole regulatory structure. Now, in Iraq, Alyssa said she was just talking with some people about it on the street. She said she asked them the question, do you think that this proves that the United States came to Iraq for the oil? And they sort of looked at her and said, of course, that was always the reason they came to Iraq, without surprise. So, the the Iraqis, a lot of Iraqis really believe that that's why we went there, and they're not really particularly outraged by this because it's sort of received, it's one of those received bits of wisdom. Take it for what it's worth.
These are short-term contracts. So what are the long-term advantages these short-term contracts give to the Western oil companies?
Well, remember, just in general, the longer these companies work in these obscure ministry offices that control enormous amounts of oil in various fields, the more familiar they become with the officials, you know, the better sort of sussed up they are on the issues and how they might put together a bid in the future that would help them gain access to those fields. But the contracts do more than that. The service contracts do more than that. They actually formally say that there will be preference given to these companies in that future bidding. I don't recall the exact language, but that's the part that's very controversial, is that they are getting not just experience with the ministries, which is already useful. They're also getting kind of a head start on any future bidding for much more lucrative oil contracts. And there's a lot of oil in Iraq, you know, at least 100 billion barrels under the ground there. And it's a lot of it is very good oil. And, of course, oil is going for, you know, $100 and up now. So, you know, the stakes are tremendous.
And one of the problems for the Western oil companies is that they've been shut out, or the role has been diminished in a lot of countries because those countries' oil companies have been nationalized, like Venezuela and Russia.
Right, think Venezuela, yeah.
So, you know, the four companies I mentioned before, ExxonMobil, BP, Total, and Shell, they, I think all four of them were members of the Iraq Petroleum Company back in the 1920s when that consortium of companies basically controlled Iraqi oil. The Iraq Petroleum Company was tossed out when Iraq nationalized its oil industry in 1961. Mm-hmm. But what does it mean that these companies that had controlled Iraqi oil are going back now?
Well, remember, they're the big guys, and they always have been. So, you know, it's natural that they're the ones who would be sort of most interested and the ones who might be invited back. But yeah, I mean, you can see history kind of going in cycles there. There's such a long history of turmoil, really, in the Iraqi oil industry. It goes all the way back to the 1920s, as you said. The British started up in the northern part of Iraq, up by Kirkuk. And that's still, you know, that's a place where insurgents are coming out of the woodwork, and they really can't export from there at this point because the pipeline keeps getting hit. Nevertheless, they're really attempting to, in a way, repeat some of the history of their oil industry and maybe get it back to where it was before. Because, you know, at one point, I mean, they were putting out much more oil than they are now in Iraq, and they've never really gotten back to that point. You know, the 1991 war really knocked it down, and they've never really put things back together again. And I think they hope to do that. And maybe part of it is, you know, thinking back to the good old days. I'm not sure why exactly they picked those precise companies.
The Bush administration said before we invaded Iraq that the profits from oil would be used to rebuild the country. Do you think these contracts bring us any closer to that possibility?
No, I don't think they have any bearing on that at all, because they already have enough money to undertake at least some degree of reconstruction. And they have, as far as we can tell, had as little success at that project as the Americans did when they were in charge.
Why?
Of
reconstruction. Why has it been so hard?
Yeah, and that's another very hard thing to understand about Iraq. You've got all this money, and it's your country, and it's fallen apart and crushed by war. Why can't you rebuild it? Well, it's a combination of things that sort of only in Iraq kind of issues. One is it's still very dangerous to go out and set up any kind of construction site. You get attacks. There's always somebody who wants to attack you. You know, it doesn't have to be the whole country. You know, it could be an insurgent group. It could be a militia. It could be just somebody who wants your bricks, you know. And then another really strange issue about Iraq is that they have a hard time spending their money because you have to have contracting officers. You have to have banks that function. You have to have a way to get raw materials into the country and transfer funds to get those raw materials. And all of those little things that we take for granted here just don't exist. Or they sort of lurch along, and there's maybe one or two people in the entire ministry who can do contracts properly because the other ones have fled or been killed or are too intimidated to come to work or just aren't skilled enough. And, you know, the transfer of money is always a difficult thing there. I mean, literally highway robbery, you know, is just a constant, constant threat in Iraq. And they're still moving cash around a lot. It's a cash-based economy. So they just can't get it done. And they say they're improving, and that's one of the issues that the Bush administration disagrees over with the GAO, the General Accountability Office, which says that they're only spending 11 to 28% of their reconstruction funds, whereas the U.S. says they're spending more than 60%.
James Glanz, although you have been, although you are the Baghdad bureau chief and you've been rotating in and out of Iraq for 4 years now, you started off at the New York Times as a science reporter. You have a PhD in astrophysics. And, you know, writing about science and studying astrophysics is a long way from covering the war in Iraq for the last 4 years. I'm sure one of the triggers to you becoming, triggers may be a wrong loaded word here, but one of the triggers for you becoming a war correspondent is when the World Trade Center was attacked. You were assigned to write about the structure of the World Trade Center and why it responded in the way it did to the jet planes that were crashed into it. And that led to a book that you co-authored about the World Trade Center. But how did you end up becoming a war correspondent?
Yeah, not the first time I've been asked that question. You're exactly right. I was, I was a former physicist. My degree is in astrophysics, writing science for the Times. And on 9/11, my friend Laura Chang, who's now the science editor, at that time she was the deputy science editor, pointed at me as I rushed in before the buildings had fallen and said one word, structure, which meant I was supposed to write a story about how these things were built. And then they fell, and so it became a story about a lot of other things, you know, starting with why they fell. And that evolved into a long term sort of beat on terrorism, and spent a lot of time at Ground Zero, as you said, wrote a book. What happened was that in terms of Iraq was I wrote a memo in 2003, and I said somebody should be covering reconstruction in Iraq. And by that time, you know, the way it works in journalism, you know, I became our sort of engineering expert. I said, you know, you need somebody over there to cover how they're going to build all the big bridges and fix the electricity grid, because that was the storyline that the administration had out there at the time. And they said, you know, you're right. Why don't you go over? So they sent me over for a one-year stint, and sort of like, you know, Gilligan's Island, you know, three-hour cruise. I re-upped and stayed there and got into the wider story. And, you know, now here we are in the present day. I'm the bureau chief. But I will say, you know, one thing about this background that I have is actually pretty nice in a place like Iraq, because so many things about our cultural background have absolutely nothing to do with the conditions over there or the things that are in people's minds and hearts and souls in that part of the world. However, it's a place that really respects engineers and has a lot of good engineers. It actually respects science to a very high degree, as long as it doesn't conflict with other you know, religious mandates and so forth. And there are a lot of very highly educated technical people there. And they and I share, oddly enough, a common language, which is this language of sort of science and engineering that's been extremely useful to me many times. A lot of the people on my staff are former engineers. They tend to learn English and be really smart, you know. And a lot of the people in government were actually educated as engineers. So, you know, be talking with somebody who's a member of parliament or something like that, and you sit there and talk for a while about bridges. You know, it gets you through the T, and the person decides you're okay, and then you can start talking about stories. So it's been a bit of an odyssey, but in my sort of strange world, it somehow makes a kind of sense.
Well, James Glanz, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you the best. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk with you.
James Glanz is the Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Hopkins, the new ABC documentary series about Johns Hopkins University Hospital. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. 8 years ago, ABC presented a nonfiction documentary series, Hopkins 24/7, which told very intimate, very real stories about the medical staff and patients at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in Baltimore. Tonight, ABC begins televising a sequel series called simply Hopkins, which our TV critic David Bianculli says is just as captivating. He also says that both the series and television have changed in the interim.
How different was TV back in 2000 when producer Terry Wrong presented his original Hopkins 24/7 series? So different that the term reality TV wasn't yet in widespread use. Survivor started that summer on CBS and jump-started the entire genre. But Hopkins 24/7, which peeked over the shoulders of doctors and nurses and gave us an unfiltered look at the way medical personnel work, think, react, and joke, was a different sort of animal. It had some narration, but no music, and it was intentionally, refreshingly adult. It didn't go in for sensationalism, which was why, in the end, it was so sensational. But now it's 2008. Not only has reality TV taken over primetime like crabgrass, but ABC itself has provided a new model for medical drama with its romance-heavy Grey's Anatomy. Hopkins, the sequel to Hopkins 24/7, is televised by ABC on the same night reserved for Grey's Anatomy, and that's no accident. Nor is it an accident that this time around, Hopkins doesn't have any narration at all, but does feature a lot of young doctors and residents, and even includes places for dreamy music and lyrics, just like Grey's Anatomy. So Terry Wrong and company have adapted to the shifting TV landscape, but they haven't sold out. They still hang around the hospital long enough and film enough footage to capture lots of interesting cases and find lots of interesting nonfiction stars. The very first one we meet, in fact, comes out of the blocks running. Or at least walking briskly through the hospital corridors, filmed by a handheld camera just like one of those frantic walk-and-talk scenes from ER. Except that this particular doctor, one of the country's leading brain surgeons, is talking directly to the camera and explaining his fascinating background as an illegal immigrant who jumped the fence as a kid to work the fields. Lou Dobbs, please take note.
20 years ago, I couldn't, not in my dreams, I thought that I was going to be doing this right here, obviously.
I was born in a small little border town between the United States and Mexico.
How are you?
And all I wanted to do when I first came to the United States is just to make a little bit of money, send it back to my family, so we could actually put food on our tables.
The only difference now is that I have gotten an education. I went to Berkeley, Harvard, UCSF, but I'm still the same person. Absolutely nothing has changed. I'm the same crazy son of a gun I was 20 years ago.
That's only one of many really captivating characters, real-life characters, not written ones, we meet in the 6 hours of Hopkins. There's also Brian, a heart and lung surgeon who's separating from his wife as the series begins. And Anne, who works in the ER at Hopkins, and with her West Virginia accent and feisty, unguarded attitude, could slip unnoticed into Grey's Anatomy, ER, or any other TV series seeking a plucky young heroine. You can almost imagine Lou Grant saying to her, "You've got spunk." But she's got honest human emotions, too. When she's driving in bad weather and passes a multi-car pileup on the side of the road, she covers her eyes and keeps on going. That doesn't seem like what someone on TV would do, but it rings as completely, refreshingly honest. Honesty, in fact, is the secret ingredient of Hopkins. Scenes involving Brian, the doctor with marital troubles, are almost too raw. We see his wife hovering nervously during a visit in episode one, and listen to one of their three young daughters as she sobs contemplating the possibility of divorce in episode two. But by episode three, things have taken a turn for the better. Happy endings aren't always part of the mix, though. Some patients we meet get lucky and get that heart or lung transplant in time. Others aren't so fortunate, and we're witness to grief, mistakes, and horrifying decisions about life and death. On occasion, we see these doctors unwinding or filling time by watching TV. A spelling bee here, a Johnny Cash special there. They watch to escape, because most TV isn't brain surgery. But on Hopkins, part of it is. Or a dual lung replacement, where the doctor handles and describes the open-chested lung so casually, providing his own play-by-play,
that it's a truly amazing display of confidence. There's usually one moment per hour where, if you're squeamish, you might look away, like the ER doctor on Hopkins passing that car crash. But for the rest of it, I promise you'll be captivated. Real life has better writers than TV does, and the stories are a lot less predictable.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song by the gospel group The Dixie Hummingbirds. The lead singer, Ira Tucker, died Tuesday of heart failure. He was 83. He sang with the Hummingbirds since the late 1930s. The group broke through to a pop audience in the 70s when they sang with Paul Simon on his hit Loves Me Like a Rock. Here's the Dixie Hummingbirds recording, Going On.
Now ever since I've been converted, I've been working for my crown. But the devil, he don't like it. He's been trying to turn me around.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at FordFound.org. And from Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The American Film Institute has issued its list of the top 10 American films within 10 different genres. On the next Fresh Air, part two of our series on the making of some of those films, Martin Scorsese talks about directing Raging Bull, and Michael Imperioli talks about his role as the kid Joe Pesci shoots in Scorsese's film Goodfellas. Join us for the next Fresh Air.